So we started Mass today with that famous and lovely hymn by John Hopkins, We Three Kings. And we've thought about the Feast of the Epiphany, all kinds of images from Botticelli and Rembrandt and Hieronymus Bosch, and all kinds of Renaissance artists come to mind of these guys, a white, a yellow, and a black one, coming in with all these fancy clothes and these big presents. And that's supposed to be the Epiphany. Well, not to put too fine a point on it, it didn't happen, folks. It just did not happen. But, having said that, and trying to figure out why Matthew did create this little fable, I think we can come to a deeper understanding of what the feast is really supposed to be all about. Epiphany, of course, as a footnote, is much older in the Christian tradition than Christmas is, because those people had a very clear understanding that in Jesus, the whole destiny of the Jews, which we saw in that little phrase from Luke last Sunday, to be a light of revelation to all the nations, was fulfilled. So why did Matthew do this? Well, it's technically called Midrash. Midrash was a technique of the rabbis and the teachers to create little stories in order to make theological points or religious points. And this should not surprise anybody, because how many of us have grown up understanding all kinds of big things about human existence because we read the story of the three little pigs, which is not about three little pigs. Of course, building houses out of straw and sticks and bricks is a question of being prescient and planning well. How many of us have been informed by the fox and the grapes about the notion of resentment and jealousy and disappointment and how that sours us? Or the stories of the emperor's new clothes, one of the most profound and perennially useful stories about human pomposity and pretentiousness. Now, you could do that. You say, well, human beings tend to be pompous and pretentious. Okay. But it is precisely in casting that in the form of a story that makes it memorable. And this is what Matthew is doing. And what we have in the visit of these people, these foreigners, they're pagans, huh? They're non-Jews. So Matthew sets this up astonishingly beautifully, as he does in instance after instance of the birth narrative, the infancy narrative. So here are these foreigners coming to the king of the Jews, Herod, to look for the real king of the Jews, and Herod's response, of course, is hypocritical. Oh, tell me when you find the kid. And of course, that's the great complaint that Matthew raises against the Jews throughout the entire gospel. You hypocrites, you whitened sepulchres. All that language is from Matthew. You do not find it anyplace else. And then, of course, you have Jesus being saved. You know, when all those little kids were killed. Mercifully, that didn't happen either. But what Matthew was doing was saying, Jesus is the new Moses. Just like Moses was saved when all the little two-year-old Jew boys apparently got killed. Whether they did or not is beyond consideration here. So Jesus, too, got spared when all those other little Jew boys got killed. And then in a true tour de force, he has Jesus being saved by reversing the central phenomenon in Jewish history, which was the Exodus, where God draws them out of Egypt to be saved. Jesus has to go to Egypt to be saved because all these hypocritical Jews want to kill him. And of course, it's summarized in the Passion narrative where Matthew has the Jews saying, we let his blood be on us and on our descendants. Please note when Matthew created that little story, too, he did not think that he was going to write something that people 2,000 years would use as a cudgel murder half the Jews in the world like the Nazis did. Matthew's problem was a problem we see in Paul, Mark, John, Luke. Namely, the question was, who was a real Jew? Who was really faithful to the God of the covenant? Those Jews who accepted Jesus as Messiah, or those Jews who did not accept Jesus as Messiah? One Matthean scholar put it this way, very nicely, I thought. He said, Matthew wrote the gospel with an eye toward the synagogue just down the street. Because here were these Jews that met to celebrate Jesus as the fulfillment of all things Jewish, the new Moses, for example, over against those Jews who refused to admit that. And that was an absolutely critical problem up until the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. Okay, so that's all useful background, I hope. But what I want to get at is the centrality of story. So that you could say, without exaggeration, to become a Christian is to take the story of Jesus as the paradigm for your own story. To appropriate the Jesus story and somehow make it your own. The story of yourself, myself. And this is not some kind of trivial, peripheral thing. Because just a little reflection indicates what? We are our stories. Quite literally, we are our stories. So that if we forget our stories, we don't know who we are. Amnesia. Frontal lobotomy. We are, as one writer puts it, essentially story-shaped people. Oh yeah, we can do all kinds of abstract stuff and make propositions and affirmations of doctrine and stuff like that, but fundamentally we are our stories. At the most profound, basic level of our own reality, we are our stories. So that if we altered it, the story of our lives, we alter our sense of who we are. So what Matthew was doing was giving us this story as a way of saying, yeah, the God of Jesus is the God of everybody. And as I said, I can't insist often enough that this is not a trivial or extraneous kind of consideration, but this goes to the heart of who we think we are. Let me finish by another piece of autobiography, which I bring up only because I know me better than I know anybody else. From the ages of 24 to 26, I could not stand my father. I never spoke to him. I hated him. I really did, quite literally. Who was my father? Mike Trojak ran away from home at 16 because his father, as I found out later, was a profound alcoholic. He was a kind of monstrous and profoundly irresponsible figure who did not support his family of his mother and her 11 children. So what was my dad? My dad was a kind of self-made man. He went to welding school, went to electrician school with his sixth grade education, and worked like mad all of his life. He said when he was forcibly retired at 65, my big regret is I was married to this paper mill, which I'd worked for 35 years. So my story of my father was he was so preoccupied, his job was so much more important than I or my two sisters. We never saw him. I read that story as his being totally indifferent to me. And then I discovered his own story. The profound sin of his father, which was to betray and fail his own family, the children he had begotten himself. And so, by God, that was the last thing my dad was about to do. Leave us without food, without clothes, without shelter. And so we'd get up at 2 o'clock in the morning when one of the turbines broke down and ride out to the paper mill and take care of it. Why? Because he loved the turbines? No, because he loved us. But you see, that's the great shift of the story for me. That this man, whose story I read as a chronicle of radical indifference to me, was rather playing out his life precisely for me and my mother and my sisters. And what happened? I experienced a conversion. Why? Because I had a different story. I was a different story. And that's, everybody in this room has comparable stories. Everybody does. Everybody on the planet does. And so, again, Matthew is trying to say to us, and first of all, say to his own group, for whom this was a life and death question. Who is a real Jew? Whose story am I to read? How am I to understand this story? So he makes up, as every Jew would understand, this little story. Say, this is who is a real Jew. The one who resists the king of the Jews, Herod, and his hypocrisy, and betrayal of his own Judaism, to buy into this little kid's story, radically different story, who was open to everybody, who was worshipped, first of all, not by his fellow Jews, but by a whole bunch of strangers. And so, once you get over the initial shock of those wonderful Botticelli, glorious paintings of, you know, these three exotically dressed people, and their camels, and their little servants, and all their big hairy presents, and say, that small beer, what's really going on is for me to try to reinterpret my whole life in the life of this man. And so to ask myself, am I a light of revelation to the Gentiles? Do I believe that Jesus is above all a light of revelation to the Gentiles? Is that my story? And therefore, to begin to try to make it my story,